November 1st, when the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity, Netanyahu accused the judges of, quote, anti-Semitic hatred toward Israel. When Donald Trump vowed to crack down on campus protests by invoking the Insurrection Act to enlist the U.S. military, he warned American colleges and universities that if they did not, quote, end anti-Semitic propaganda, unquote, they would lose accreditation and federal financial support. Today, one of the oldest and most virulent forms of hatred, anti-Semitism, is being weaponized as a cudgel to silence opposition to Israel's war against the Palestinians. If you criticize Israel, you are an anti-Semite. If you condemn Zionism, you are an anti-Semite. If an international court with 125 member countries dedicated to what Kofi Annan called the cause of all humanity accuses Israel, and it's important to note also Hamas military commander Mohammed Diouf, of war crimes, the judges from France, Benin, and Slovenia are guilty of anti-Semitism. The founders of Israel willingly took on a known risk when they established a Jewish state, choosing sacred religious symbols, the Star of David as the official state insignia on the nation's flag, the menorah as the official state emblem, and Hebrew as the official language. In 2018, the Knesset doubled down by passing a law designating Israel the, quote, nation state of the Jewish people. The chairman of the special legislative committee that drafted the law described it as simply confirming the founding principle on which the state was established, that, quote, everyone has human rights, but national rights in Israel belong only to the Jewish people. The Adalah Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel said the law, quote, contains key elements of apartheid. During the hotly contested debate over Zionism in the 19th and early 20th centuries, anti-Zionists and non-Zionists repeatedly warned that establishing a Jewish state would pose grave dangers, not only to indigenous Arab inhabitants, but to Jews around the world. Today, that complex history has been largely replaced by an official sanitized version that doggedly erases the many Jewish voices that have sounded well-grounded alarms over the establishment of a militarized theocracy. To examine these important issues, we've invited Professor Marjorie Feld, the author of a new groundbreaking book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism. She is a professor of history at Babson College and the author of Nations Divided, American Jews and the Struggle Over Apartheid. Professor Feld, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book offers new insight into a history that has frequently been buried or minimalized. How does your research challenge the typical narratives in the American Jewish community about our historic relationship to Israel and to Zionism?
Yes, this is a great question, and I appreciated in your introduction your reference to that history as sanitized, right, as having been partially erased, because the typical narrative in American Jewish history is really one of a triumphant history of this so-called consensus on American Zionism that emerged within American Jewish life. This was really a certain brand of American Zionism that marked unqualified support for Israel. And we were taught to think that any criticism of Zionism in Israel not only emerged as a force from outside of American Jewish life, but also was really damaging, in fact, dangerous to American Jewish security and to the security of Jews around the world. So my book is in part, along with lots of other scholars and lay people, a corrective to that narrative. It documents criticism of Zionism in Israel and concern for Palestinian rights, as well as other concerns over this brand of American Zionism. And importantly, it marks that this criticism emerged first within American Jewish life. So what I really try to do in the book is to document the fact that American Jewish Zionists and anti-Zionists and non-Zionists, that they all were wrestling with questions about how to balance, you know, like deep concern for Jewish safety with a desire for a vibrant communal life. And they wanted to combine that with faith in America, American values, and also universalist ideas of human rights and equality. So I think it's important to note that all of these American Jews, both the Zionists and those who criticize Zionism, assigned different meanings to those values. And they were all part of these contests about what it meant to be Jewish and American in the, you know, beginning in the turn of the 20th century through to today. I think these are, you know, pretty universal questions about how to belong to a group and show what it means to belong to that group in your everyday life, but also walking around as a citizen of the world and balancing universalist values with that. So the book is really, I hope, about competing models of American Jewish priorities across the century.
Today, Jewish anti-Zionism is most frequently associated with the political left. In the early 20th century, that relationship was more complicated, with Jewish anti- or non-Zionism frequently, though certainly not always, associated with the community's German Jewish elites. Why did anti-Zionism especially appeal to some communal elites? And what might this mean for modern-day leftists looking for a legacy?
I think it's really important to note this early chapter in my book, which is indeed an early chapter in critics, American Jewish critics of Zionism and of this emerging so-called consensus, were very elite Jewish Americans. The emergence of their criticism of Zionism was in this early part of the 20th century, when there was real fear and precarity to American Jewish life, right? It was a really savagely racist and xenophobic era. It was nativist, anti-Asian racism. We're talking about the Jim Crow era. It was, and the debates were seen as having very high stakes because these elite American Jews, many of them of German descent, part of the American Council for Judaism, which was founded in the early 40s, they wanted safety and success for their families in the midst of this xenophobic era. They wanted to achieve and then, of course, maintain their elite status as business owners. And they also wanted to be proud American Jews. So I think it's interesting that their resistance to Zionism emerged from a sense of danger, the danger associated with claims of dual loyalty, right? That if you're loyal to a nation outside of the United States, that the United States polity itself, the people within the United States, will doubt that you're a good citizen, a good American. So they resisted Zionism mainly for that reason. And so in that way, I think it would be easy to dismiss these elite anti-Zionists, you know, as trying to maintain elite status, as really just trying to appear as good Americans. But when I went into the archives to do research on this group, I found that some of their questions are indeed enduring and might be useful to modern day non-anti-Zionist, modern day critics of the American Zionist state, for instance, right? They were really raising questions about who gets to speak on behalf of American Jews. Is it the people who have unquestioning loyalty to the emerging Zionist movement or those who are more critical? They were really wondering about the emerging Jewish religious schools and synagogues and Jewish community centers. Does Zionism and Jewish nationalism have to dominate and be the center of those curricula? They were really worried, too, about money flowing outward to Israel and not, you know, leading to a flourishing American Jewish community. So these are some enduring questions that emerged out of the elite German Jewish community. And I'll also say that my book, as well as Jeff Levin's really terrific book, Our Palestine Question, follows some of these elite German Jews who were in this council, this anti-Zionist organization in the 40s through to the 50s and 60s, when they really became concerned about Palestinian rights. And they were some of the only organized Jewish leaders to really show concern about Palestinians, what they would have called the Arab refugee problem in the 50s and 60s.
Marjorie, while you cite sources complaining about critics of Zionism being called anti-Semitic as early as 1937, there was clearly more room for different perspectives on Zionism in the Jewish community before the 40s and 50s. What changed in that era to initially lower, in your words, the threshold of dissent? And take a moment to define your concept of the threshold of dissent.
Sure. So a threshold is something after which, you know, there is penalty or punishment. And what I try to chronicle in the book is that in the 1890s and 1900s, as the global Zionist movement was beginning and took root in the United States, there was a high tolerance for all kinds of discussions about what centering Jewish nationalism might mean, about what a Jewish state might look like, about how American Jewish life might organize itself around the question of a Jewish state. And so there was a lot of dissent, as we would put it in, I guess, contemporary terms. Then, I don't have to tell your listeners or you that the Holocaust had just a monumental, devastating impact on Jewry worldwide. The destruction of the Holocaust in the eyes of many, many American Jews and Jews around the world called for unity in the face of trauma. And American Jewish leaders really called for unity and said that only through unity would American Jews and really all Jews be safe. So they saw in Palestine, which in 48 obviously became Israel, they saw a solution to the problem of stateless Jews and began to frame Israel as a place that would where Jews would always be safe. And so there was a very, very strong feelings in the face of this destruction and trauma that American Jews couldn't show the non-Jewish world any internal divisions. And I say this, and it's it continues to resonate, right? I can remember people in my grandparents' generation very fearful of showing any internal divisions, that American Jews must stand united. And so that became, in some ways, the rallying cry, the motivation, the underlying goal of unified consensus on American Zionism, on approaches to Israel. The stakes for safety felt very, very high. And so the threshold for dissent was really lowered, right? You have Israel allying with the United States in the Cold War. And so this alliance with Israel made sense geopolitically. Even if anti-Semitism lost much of its legitimacy in the United States because of the Holocaust, a lot of American Jews still felt this keen sense of loss with all of the connections to the Holocaust and its destruction. So, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you have American Jews, many of them, not all of them, getting college degrees, moving into the suburbs, building generational wealth. And Zionism and support for Israel really became, I guess, what we call differentiators, something that made American Jews feel distinct, feel visible, stay mobilized, something to fundraise around, while joining, you know, white folks in the suburbs. And I would also add that, you know, the concerns that reform elite Jews, whom we already talked about, those concerns that they held close weren't really relevant because American Judaism and Americanism, they felt now was entirely compatible with Zionism. So all of these developments helped to make room for Zionist leaders who really emphasized the threshold of dissent. There were American Jews voicing concern for Palestinians who rejected the idea that unqualified support for Israel would keep American Jews and all Jews safe. And these American Jews were calling for, you know, more representative, more open communal institutions, broader conversations. So there were these continued contests of the priorities over American Jewish communal life. Continuing quest for safety in the face of the Holocaust.
Marjorie, one of the interesting episodes you write about is the experience of Martin Blatt, a Jewish Tufts University student in the anti-war movement, who in 1973 taught a class called Zionism Reconsidered and caused a firestorm, attracting the ire of local Jewish communal bodies and the Anti-Defamation League. There are similarities between this and contemporary campus controversies, obviously. More about the Black Tufts controversy and how it compares to what we're seeing on campus today.
Sure. So one of the things to note about this book is that it took me about 7 years to write. So it was the research in the archives was pre-COVID, and leafing through the files of the Anti-Defamation League in the Boston archive. There was just so much vitriol around it that I was really interested and drawn in. And then I happily found Marty Blatt living in Cambridge, which is nearby to me and to my college. And so I engaged with him in sort of open conversations about what had unfolded and what the ADL had been tracking in 73. So I'll just tell you a little bit about what happened. Blatt came of age in the 50s. His grandparents were from Poland and Germany. He had a grandfather who died in a Nazi prison camp. And he was raised in a liberal Zionist family, very social justice oriented. But when he came to Tufts in 1971, he took a course with Uri Davis, who's a left political figure in Israel. And he started to see connections between injustice in Vietnam. He was already very active in the anti-war movement, and injustice in Israel-Palestine. He traveled to Israel in the summer of 72. And he was interviewing dissenters, Israelis who refused to serve in the military. And he actually co-wrote a book about this. But, I think in our current moment, when we see college campuses really riven with debates and in some cases really cracking down over dissent on Israel, Tufts, after he took this course with Uri Davis at the Tufts Experimental College, Marty decided to offer a course called Zionism Reconsidered. This wasn't his first foray into Israel-Palestine activism. He had actually founded, I think this might also be interesting, a Hillel non-Zionist caucus. He felt, he and others, other Jewish students, felt that the Hillel chapter, which is, of course, a Jewish organization that rests on many college campuses, they felt it was too Zionist-oriented. So he formed a non-Zionist caucus, and Hillel expelled him and his friends from the organization for forming this caucus. But after he took Uri's course, he decided to teach his own course in the Experimental College, this Zionism Reconsidered course, and it really traced the history of Zionism. Some of the students in the class, they were all undergraduates, were Zionists, some were not. But he talked about Palestinian resistance, and he talked about Israel's Cold War alliance with the U.S. It was really important to him that he teach the students that anti-Zionism was not anti-Semitism. And he actually, it was kind of a professor's dream. He got very positive evaluations from his students. And then in March, midway through the semester, members of the Jewish Defense League, which is a far-right anti-Arab Jewish nationalist group, they marched into Blatt's class uninvited, and they called it an anti-Jewish outrage. And so they passed out a flyer that said, not since Germany in the days of Hitler has any university dared to offer a course presenting a one-sided view of any national movement. And following this incident, there were just huge debates in the Boston Jewish press, in the Boston non-Jewish press. Mainstream Jewish leaders were alerted to this class, the Zionism Reconsidered class, and they urged the campus, they urged the Tufts president to shut the class down. Meanwhile, a lot of students were defending Marty's right to teach the class, and including many of the students who were in the class. So I went to the Tufts archives to look at the language of some of the letters that community members had written in the face of this incident. And it was totally apocalyptic language, right? They liken Marty's class, Zionism Reconsidered, to the destruction of the Jewish people. They see any teaching about Palestine as causing harm. They said it was endangering Jewish students, that it was endangering Jewish life. They called it an insult to the Jewish community. They called it propaganda. And the sort of biggest editorial which appeared in the Jewish Advocate was the Boston Jewish Press. The headline was Tufts Anti-Zionist Course Seen as Abuse of Academic Freedom. So there is sort of all of the conversations going on in the press. But most devastating, I think, was that during this controversy, Marty picked up the phone one day, and someone who clearly knew his family history in the Holocaust told him that his parents shouldn't have been saved. So there's these, all of these layers of connection to the trauma of the Holocaust in his story. And ultimately, Tufts decided to stand by his right to teach the class. He actually taught it the next semester. But he was really ostracized from the Jewish community, Marty Blatt, for teaching this class. And this uproar just sounds so familiar in our current moment, right? With all of the crackdowns on the encampments. And I think I would also say that the parallel can be found in the deep desire for young people to have access to knowledge about the history of Palestine, about the Nakba, the expelling and dispossession of Palestinians with the founding of Israel in 48. And my goodness, right now, you know, with concerns over how Title VI might be used to treat dissent on college campuses, which is to say, to what degree are we going to allow academic freedom to continue to thrive, to have students' needs for education on Israel and Palestine met? This is a, you know, an enduring question, an ongoing concern. And this happened in 1973. So I think it seemed monumental to me in the moment when I found it, which was even before October 7th. And I think the ripples of this continue still today, even more profoundly in our current moment and as we head into a new administration.
We can only wish today's universities had had the courage to do what Tufts did back then. That's a very revealing story, Marjorie. You're listening to Law and Disorder with our guests, Professor Marjorie Feld. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. Marjorie, today we're seeing an unprecedented explosion of activism from Jewish leftist groups that are non- or anti-Zionist and critical of Israel, like If Not Now and the Jewish Voice for Peace. How does your research help us think about this current moment? Are there lessons these activists might learn from their predecessors? What are your current observations on the divisions in American Jewish communal life with regard to Israel and Zionism?
Right. Such a telling, important question. One of the themes that I really try to trace in the book is the cost of this low threshold of dissent. I talk a lot about how these choices made by American Jewish leaders to marginalize, defund dissenters from the American Jewish brand of Zionism, how it distanced American Jewish communal life from progressive movements or campaigns. I talk a lot about civil rights, but I think that's true of sort of anti-colonial campaigns in general. As Black and Arab and Palestinian Americans were joining these movements that criticized the Nakba, that criticized Israel's human rights abuses, and I'm speaking in the past tense here, a lot of American Jews felt, and you'll see this phrase again and again, quote unquote, forced to choose. They felt forced to choose between American Jewish affiliation with its unqualified support for Israel and support for these progressive movements, for anti-colonialist movements. And as a result, the organized Jewish world really dropped out of a lot of meaningful, lasting, committed memberships in some of these movements. So there was a cost to the lowering of this threshold of dissent. You know, if you look in the late 90s and the early O's, you see that JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, and then, you know, more recently, If Not Now, took on positions where they're really trying to build up, again, a Jewish left. They're trying to build up Jewish alliances with anti-colonialist movements, which I think are really central to dissent in American Jewish life, dissent to some of the forces that are ascendant right now, such as white nationalism. And so I think when now that we see JVP and If Not Now and so many other liberal and left groups showing up at synagogues in Jewish communal life, showing up on the American, you know, political stage, I think it's important that we're opening up conversations about dissent in the past so that these American Jewish folks can find role models can recognize that there's always been dissent in American Jewish life, that it can't be simply, dismissed or washed away as fringe, because we have to take accountability for the fact that American Jewish organizational leaders tried to silence, took money away from those who occupy these positions of dissent. So I think there's a legacy there. They can look to that legacy. We can also build back up some of these coalitions working in really important progressive movements. I think those are all really important. And I'll just say that I think it's not incidental that these groups are very open to dissent on Israel-Palestine. In fact, they're sort of leading the way on this, but also they're really forward-thinking in terms of fighting racism and homophobia and classism and transphobia within Jewish communal life. So I see this as a really grand opportunity for American Jewish life to take stock of this history, to invest in a sustainable future that fights these isms and becomes more inclusive, that shifts its priorities away from unqualified loyalty to Israel and really aligns with what we're seeing in the data as the position of younger people in the United States, Jews and non, which is a more critical view toward Israel and a wish to realize peace for Palestinians and Israelis both.
That gives us a positive approach to moving forward. Marjorie, where can listeners learn more about your book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism, as well as your ongoing research?
Well, I appreciate that. I always try to end on a positive note because I think there's this window of opportunity. Anybody who's interested in the book, it's published by NYU Press, so their website is a place to look. I'm also a big fan of bookshop.org. So if folks want to purchase the book, that's a place to look. There are places all around in JVP and If Not Now circles and social media websites to find information on these movements, broadly speaking.
Marjorie, one of the pleasures of doing this radio show and podcast is meeting people like yourself. I was so impressed by your book. Folks can find my favorable review of your book at the Marquez Review. We are very grateful for you joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
Need answers? Try our interactive tax assistant on irs.gov/ITA. Simply select your tax questions, provide your information, and it gives you answers. Also, check our help and resources page and try our online tax map. 5,000 tax topics from A to Z. Plus, you can access forms, publications, in a variety of formats.
Come on, man. Wake up. Welcome to the reservation. Because the Bill of Rights does not apply to Indian people living on a federally recognized Indian reservation. The Constitution of the United States of America does not apply to any Indian living on an Indian reservation. So welcome to the reservation. Welcome to the reservation.
That's Russell Means, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Russell Means. Welcome to the reservation. Indigenous communities are among the poorest in the United States. This is one of the many persistent symptoms of the colonial relationship imposed by force upon Indigenous peoples. As famed historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz says, neither arcane colonial laws nor the historical trauma of genocide simply disappear with time, and certainly not when conditions of life and consciousness perpetuate them. From the earliest days of colonial settlement, a theme of eliminating Indians in the name of expansion and settler opportunity became embedded into the U.S. political system and culture. The violence unleashed on the largely defenseless Indian nations had few parallels in history. Treaties and policies involving indigenous peoples have consistently been designed to disadvantage them, locking them into suppressed social status and codifying their dependence on the U.S. government. Our guest today is Russell Means, a renowned activist for indigenous rights. In Oglala Lakota, he was born on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He was a founding member of the American Indian Movement, AIM, and its first national director. He passed away in 2012. This never-before-broadcast program was recorded at Bowdoin College in Maine in 1992. And now, Russell Means, welcome to the reservation.
Hamitakwepi. Miyama Lakota. Imagianta hawaki and zitiospai, kile, chesapa kin, lila wakan. Maka wakan. I said in my language, part of a traditional greeting I am bound to give because I come from an oral society. I said, hello, my relatives. I am an ally. And I come from our very sacred holy land, the Black Hills, which is in what is called the state of South Dakota now. The white man calls us Sioux Indians. You know, a long time ago, almost half a century, my grandfather told me a story, and I want to relate it to you all. He said, a long time ago, the people were sitting around the campfire. He said, and the men began to watch the women grow with child. And as they continued to watch, they witnessed the miracle of life, the miracle of birth. And then they saw that new life, that new miracle taken by the woman. And they nurtured that new life at their breast. And they watched that baby begin to grow. That was the end of his little story to me when I was 5 or 6 years old. My grandfather would take me on walks when I was 6 years old, 5 years old, and tell me many stories about my people, some of which I've forgotten. I remember that one. And I've added this to that story, that the men begin to look at one another and poke themselves. So what are we doing here? Well, I've come to find out what my grandfather meant. Because in the universe, there's a female-male balance. And throughout all of life on this sacred grandmother, the Mother Earth, there's a female-male balance in all of life, except among us, the two-leggeds, the human beings. And so we here in the Western Hemisphere, now there are exceptions to the rules, and for you anthros and archies that may be here, I acknowledge those exceptions. But the rule, and each exception, by the way, only goes to prove the rule. The rule was that we built our societies to reflect the female-male balance in the universe and on this sacred earth. So we had matrilineal societies based upon the clan system. It's in our songs and in our humor. The female lives longer than the male. It's a natural fact. So we, when we marry, we go to live where the female is from. Because when we die, we want our wife and children to be around her friends and relatives. The clan system is the answer to world peace. Of course, the anthros haven't gotten that far yet. And the archaeologists, a broken piece of pottery hasn't told them that yet. Or any of our bones that they use for ashtrays and displays and for storage bins, to fill up storage bins, that class known as grave robbers to us, but a science to you all, the science of archaeology. Grave robbers, pure and simple. I have no feelings whatsoever for either one of those alleged sciences, or for the hissies, the historians, the archies, anthros, and hissies, or any of the ologists, because those are the professions that continue the genocide, are principally responsible for the continuing genocide against my people. You see, we've been a expendable people since 1492, and 500 years later, we still are. I talk and lecture all over this country, and I build coalitions all over this country with other peoples of the sacred colors. And usually I run into Americans that say, well, it's my fault. That happened 100 years ago. Want to bet? Come down to where I live. And you will see the Navajos being forcibly relocated. Traditional Indian Navajos, who are a burden to no taxpayer and are self-sufficient, being forcibly relocated by the United States of America because they happen to be self-sufficient on a bed of coal. It's happening right now, tonight. Or go to the James Bay Cree up in Canada. Or the Inupiae and the Yupik, are commonly referred to as Eskimos of Alaska. Go to the Hawaiians or the American Samoans or the Micronesians. Go to Mexico, Peru, Guatemala, Nicaragua. Go anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, and my people are expendable. We can't even get a collective yawn from America. We went in 1969, the American Indian people, even though we our average lifespan is 44.5 years in this country, lower than the Indian people of Guatemala, the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. Irrespective of that fact and all the other factors of poverty, the deprivation that that brings upon human beings. We were the fastest growing ethnic group in America in 1969. After the initiation in 1972 of that sterilization program, 4 years later, we were at less than zero population growth. So you see, after 500 years of discovering that clown who washed up on a beach in the Caribbean, saving him from his mutinous crew, we have nothing to celebrate. I'm talking about Cristobal Colón, or better known to you all as Christopher Columbus. Reservations has been turned into a racist term in America. People assume that the United States of America and its benevolence gave us these reservations. Well, America has conveniently hid from your history the expansionism of the West. All you hear about the imperialist march of America is the expansionism of the West, west of the Mississippi. Over 80 different Indian nations east of the Mississippi were wiped off the face of the earth. Indian nations that were common right on the very ground you're sitting on right now. The legacy of America. The legacy and the heritage of my people. My son's people. My granddaughter's people. The reservations were not given to us. The word reservation comes from the word reserve. We reserve that land to ourselves. All of those people who did not reserve land are now extinct. That's why there are very, very, you know, this many reservations east of the Mississippi. Because if they weren't exterminated off the face of the earth, they were forced to march west. Ask the Shawnee. So reservations, we reserve that land. In almost every instance, by treaty, guaranteed by Article 6 in the United States Constitution, that says treaties are the law of the land, equal to the Constitution. 371 treaties. So we told the United States, our leaders did, our spokespeople in the last century, we tried to tell the American people, listen, if your government doesn't live up to the treaties, you're going to suffer. The Six Nations people of the United States and Canada, they attempted to tell the League of Nations back in 1926 when they sent an emissary over to Geneva. And he attempted to tell the League of Nations that if the United States cannot live up to its international agreements that it made with Indian nations, then what can the rest of the world expect? Nobody listened. Again in the 1950s, again in the 1960s, again in the 1970s, again in the 1980s, we continually tell you all, it's going to come back on you. Watch out. Be responsible. Be responsible for the government of the United States of America. So what has happened? Now you're living on the biggest reservation in the world. It's called the United States of America. If anybody that hangs around Washington, D.C. eventually has a brain full of mush. All you have to do is watch TV, right? Watch there. That what passes for rhetoric comes out of their mouth, that garbage, and people still get in line and vote. Isn't there a parable from the European legacy about the lemmings who were led by, what's that guy's name, the Pied Piper, to the wharf? Isn't that supposed to teach you something, that kind of a story? You want to know about health insurance? Well, come on down. Come on down to my reservation. The Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, where Wounded Knee is. We are the poorest county in America. Our health conditions are worse than any other health conditions anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. These is all statistical facts. Come on down, see the health care we have. Come on into Indian country, find out about health care. My mother's dead because of that health care. I'm deaf in this ear because of that health care. You want some other horror stories? Because I've protested about the torture and murder of babies in the hospitals on Indian reservations. I've led marches, and you're talking about national health care. Look at your education, which 10 years ago, let's go back even further. When I was in public school in the 1950s, the United States of America was ranked number one in the country, in the world, as far as education of its youth is concerned. Today, it's 19th. And just in the last 8 years, it slipped 2 places. When I started all this stuff and started studying it back in 84, the United States was ranked 17th. And in 8 years, it went 2 more places. There are countries that educate their young better than this country does. And those countries you don't even know. You've never heard of. And it's government education. It's called public school, but it's a government school, man. So go to the reservation. You'll see the same result. Look at the inner city statistics on education. They have finally, since the 60s, they were one-third lower than our dropout rate. Now the inner city dropout rate is equal to the Indian dropout rate on the national scale. It's at 40%. Come on down to the reservation. I can never understand how an educational system devised in the 10th century has any validity for today. The system that you're sitting in right now was devised in the 10th century by the Holy Roman Catholic Church. And you think it has relevance to today? Health and education. Living proof that you're living in a reservation. Everything you hear on TV. You know? You're not old enough. Some of you are. I'm certainly old enough to remember when the values of this country were such that newspaper companies had newspaper stands on virtually every corner in the cities of America, at every bus stop, man. And those newspapers were sitting there free, just laying there. But they trusted you to put a dime in. It cost a dime, man. Put a dime in and take just one paper. Today, it's a miniature vault. Get a newspaper. Where are those values, man? How many locks do you have? You're fortunate in Maine because you're not that close to the citadels of depravity like New York City et al. But I'm talking about the values of America, man. Go to our Indian reservation. You'll see the same thing, theft, lack of values. I remember when you didn't have to lock your bicycle in America. Now you go in a hardware shop and those locks that are needed for bicycles, holy mackerel. Tempered steel, the whole bit, man. Welcome to the reservation. And I'll give you a clue in your own history. Every immigrant group that came here, save one, were family-based. Every one of those immigrant groups became economically viable once they got to this country. The latest example are the Asians. They come from a family-based culture. But then after a generation or two, they become Americans. When the children are champing at the bit, man, but to turn 18 so they can leave home. That's sad, man. Your child wants to leave home? The immigrant group who were forced here as slaves And so they are still struggling to become economically viable in America, in the United States. That's the African people. My people, by your government's policy that is supposed to live up to the Constitution of the United States that y'all got from us. And no thank yous. They've destroyed our family, so we're dependent on the government. Literally and figuratively dependent. Welcome to the reservation. Because America, that's all you hear. Are the historians telling you this? The anthros? The archaeologists? The grave robbers? Huh? Have you learned these things? How free are you? Are you economically free? To have a family? No! When I was growing up, my father, who was a welder, could afford to raise my brothers and I, four of us, my wife and his wife, my mother, stayed at home. They brought home a weekly paycheck. And we owned our own home. Had one car. We weren't rich. We weren't middle class. But he could afford to have his family. Today, it is mandatory that both parents work just to survive in this economy. That is not freedom. When your economic freedom is taken away, everything else is taken away, and you become dependent on government. Welcome to the reservation. Free enterprise. What's free enterprise? One oil company goes down one year, swallowed up by another oil company, another corporation swallowed up by another corporation. The antitrust laws passed in 1912, 1914. It's a joke. Your Constitution is a joke. Your Bill of Rights are a joke. In December, when the USA had a special issue celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, on the front page, and I forget the guy's name from the White House, close aide to Bush, told the reporter, told the USA Today, that the Bill of Rights is a good guide. It's a good guide. What? I took the newspaper around. I was at this center, all white people. And I went around. I said, look at this, man. They said the Bill of Rights is a good guide. Went out to person after person trying to get some kind of interest in their rights, man. And they were too busy. The President of the United States, where the buck stops here, right, has in his employ everyone who says the Bill of Rights a good guide. Come on, man. Wake up. Welcome to the reservation. Because the Bill of Rights does not apply to Indian people living on a federally recognized Indian reservation, nor a state reservation. The Constitution of the United States of America does not apply to any Indian living on an Indian reservation. That is fact. So welcome to the reservation. You have no rights. And nobody's marching, man. Nobody's indignant. I had the national president of the Future Farmers of America in my home in Chinle, Arizona, a couple of years ago, along with the local chapter president, high school student. She was a senior. He was in a first year college. And they were so eager to get their agricultural degree and get back to farm management for corporations. And they both came from a family farm. But their ambition was to sell themselves to corporate socialism. I couldn't believe it. You have to have a family. You know, I believe in all that rhetoric about equal pay for equal work. But when I was a teenager, they didn't have minimum wage. In my first year of college, I worked my way through college. My first year of college out there in California, I had to work at less than what you call minimum wage. Equal pay for equal work, that's very just. But it's not addressing the economic system of this country. William Scherer wrote and prophesied what was going to happen to you all. He said, America is going to be the first country in history to go fascist democratically. Over 50% of the homes in America are one-parent homes. That's a dangerous statistic. And of course, about 48% of the rest of the homes, both parents have to work. And so you want national daycare centers. Come on down to the reservation and look at our parent and child care centers, they're called. PCC on my reservation, for short. We want nationally government-funded daycare centers. I'm in wonderment. Because you go over to Europe, and you can see that those are family-based economies that have stood the test of time. Now, nothing's perfect. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about a political system. I'm talking about values, man.
You're listening to Russell Means. Welcome to the Reservation. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
And everyone wonders why the productivity of America is down. Why other countries are now overtaking us. Where's your jobs? You worried about jobs. That's the syndrome they use on reservation and always have. Every 2 years on my reservation. Remember, we're the poorest. We get an election, okay? Just like y'all. I think you guys even get more frequent elections because you got municipal election, county election, state election, and national elections. We get one election every 2 years. And they come and tell us about jobs. I call it the job syndrome. They get you all focused in on getting a job. And you don't think about yesterday or tomorrow, because all you're thinking about is today. So you don't have time to walk with respect on our sacred grandmother, the Mother Earth. You don't have time for that, because you're in the mode of survival. Welcome to the reservation. Because all you're doing now, you're not living, you're surviving. And the people without family, and I say, look at the Indians and look at the Africans, and you will see that they are more easily controlled if their family base is destroyed. And look at America. Look at the electorate. Look at what you get, man. The Demopublicans. That's all you get. The perfect one-party system. And you call this a democracy? The perfect one-party system. Because the Demos have the legislature. Republicans have the executive branch. So they escape responsibility. Something goes wrong, they point fingers at one another. The perfect one-party system. And y'all fall for it. Went down to Mexico City last week with my wife. A country whose only viable export is agriculture. A country with homeless. We were going to take our children. But my in-laws believed everything you've ever heard about Mexico City. Don't drink the water. Because of the peso has gone downhill, man, it's really bad in Mexico and blah, blah, this. Went down to Mexico City. You almost are asphyxiated as soon as you get out outside the airport, ma'am, because that smog is thick. You can almost cut it with scissors. But it's a clean city. You don't see any homeless. And everyone is hustling, working on the streets. They're doing things. They're using their beat-up jalopies that they got down by their house or their tin shack. They're using that to be a taxi. They're doing everything they can to put money in their pockets and food on the table and shelter over their head. But they're working. They're on the streets, all over the streets, selling things. All over. Open market. That's what you call free market. And I was reading in the Mexican paper, newspaper, about how all the businessmen now are petitioning the government to stop these street vendors because they're taking away business. It's always perplexed me about capitalists that you're a staunch capitalist until you own a business. Then you're against free market economics. You don't want competition, man. You know, you want it all yourself. It's amazing. It's amazing, the contradiction there. But I wanted to use Mexico City as an example of how this country tells you about the other places in the world, and you think that you're well off in a democracy. 42% of your income goes to government in taxes. In the history of the world, everyone, including the serfs of the feudal times, they rebelled and had revolutions when the tithe of their monarchies demanded up to 25%. When they had to give up 25% of their hard-earned income to a government, they rebelled. You guys are setting, or your folks, are setting history. A precedent. You're the first country that is allowing yourself to be robbed blind by your own government. 17% more than anybody else in history. Everybody else rebelled. Got rid of those governments that were oppressing them. I'm talking about the serfs, man. Welcome to the reservation. I mean, these are facts. Blame the Japanese. Point the finger. Point the finger at the Mexicans. Point the finger at the Japanese. Point it at the Taiwanese, at the Thais. Just start pointing fingers all over. Nobody's pointing a finger at Germany or at England, which owns more land than all the other countries combined in this country. People from England own more, they own more businesses in America than the Japanese. But nobody's pointing a finger at England. Then you can get these facts in the worst newspaper in America. You just read it. It's in USA Today, in a little corner. Every once in a while, you get these facts, man. Welcome to the reservation. You're getting poorer and poorer. You know, the United States of America, economically speaking, is a banana republic now. It amazed me, Mexico City, a city of 21 million. 21 million. What's New York City have? 8 million? No homeless, man. And they're in a temperate climate. They never wear coats. Never, man. But I go to New York City often in the wintertime, in the dead of winter. And it's homeless. In every neighborhood now, in every neighborhood. There used to be exclusive neighborhoods where they weren't, you know, just a few short years ago, but now the homeless are in every neighborhood. The East 50s, up on the West End, they're everywhere. Columbus Circle. And it's sad. This is also, statistically speaking, the most violent country in America. The most violent. A democracy? A democracy is the most violent? Per capita, the United States leads the world in the percentage of population in prisons. This is a democracy?
You've got a constitution. You've got a Bill of Rights. Then why do you have the IRS? Why do you have the FDA? Why the FCC? Or anybody or anything else in the alphabet? The BIA.
This sucks. Chop, 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 chop.